I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's time for the Fantasy Points Podcast, brought to you by FantasyPoints.com. Top-level fantasy football and NFL betting analysis from every perspective and angle, from numbers to the film room, with a single goal: to help you score more fantasy points.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to or watching live the Fantasy Points Podcast. Very special guest today, the one and only Sigmund Bloom. I think I've told this story on your show a few times, Sig, but I want to hit it here. So I was like a baseball diehard. I started in the industry as a fantasy baseball writer, obsessed with that. And I didn't like really fall in love with football, fantasy football in particular, until right out of college. I was working this soul-sucking 9-to-5 job that I was just so miserable at. The only benefit was you could just listen to podcasts while you did your work, or you have your headphones in while you're working all day. And I found your podcast and I just became obsessed. I listened to every single episode you did. Really caused me to fall in love with fantasy football. I just didn't hear anyone thinking about things on your level. I've always said you're fantasy football's best philosopher. It's just like kind of how your mind works, very outside the box thinker. I don't think I would be here where I am if it wasn't for you and your podcast. And whenever I do your show, it's the only show I still get really nervous for, because like that's how much your show means to me. But hopefully now that I'm on my home turf, now you're on my couch,
right?
Things are a little different. We'll see.
Yeah. Thanks for that. And, you know, like so many other people, Will Sandbox, your work has far surpassed anything that I've done. Dedicate with depth and breadth, chatting last week considerably. Well, that's more reassuring for me at this point. A lot of this in the fantasy football world at large is that in a time, in an era, whenever we have a lot of worries, we're all traumatized, we're all struggling, we're all trying to reconstitute things that have been broken or never even activated in our lives that are supposed to nourish our spirits, our souls. We have created this space, a safe space, if you will, where we get to gather around a fire of not football, not professional football, but the complete commitment of all the people involved in professional and what it creates. And then we can hang out and enjoy it together. And so many people are doing it in so many ways that I feel like we are at a golden age of be fluent and conversant these topics. We can have just the most amazing conversations about them.
Yeah, I agree. It's crazy. Like you go back and you watch a draft from 8 years ago, the level of discourse versus what it is today. It's at such a higher level, elevated consciousness, if you will. At the end of every show, you always ask me some off the wall non-football questions. I know we talked about Alan Watts one time.
Uh-huh.
And so I'll have to come up with something good for you at the end of the show. You always have good answers. So you brought up the Sigmund Bloom pre-draft 100, always been one of my favorite articles to read. And I said this to you in DMs, is like, it feels like I'm saying this every year, but we are very aligned. And like your article dropped before my wide receiver article, and very, very similar. with these wide receivers. And so I kind of just want to like dig into this article and kind of ask your question, some questions, see where we're aligned, maybe the few instances where we're not. But I'm looking at the top, the Superflex top 25, right? And so you see Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, Marvin Harrison Jr., Malik Nabers, Romo Odunze, Brock Bowers. Nothing surprising at all to me there. I know it's different for some other people, but that feels just about perfect to me. The question I have for you is, how tight was it in between Caleb Williams and Jaden Daniels? Because this is something that's been keeping me up at night, is should Jaden Daniels be the QB1 in this class? And I know that's crazy because everyone's like, oh, Caleb Williams is this generational talent. He has DJ Moore. He is Keenan Allen. It's impossible to fail. Caleb Williams is not Brett Whitefield, our preeminent film mind director of charting and fantasy points, not his QB1. Had a lot of concerns. But more importantly, it's just Jaden Daniels, the element he brings as a runner, that Konami code upside, that cheat code upside. Right. And you hear people talk about him. It's like, well, maybe he's Lamar Jackson. He might even be a better thrower than Lamar Jackson, or rich man's RG3. And then the floor is Justin Fields. And it's like, I mean, that's great. Justin Fields was a mid-range QB1 every time he was on the field. And like, he was not good. And like, I think this guy's way better. And to just have that Konami code, cheat code upside is just like so massive in fantasy. So my question to you, how tight was it between these two names? And like, do you see any, do you find that argument at all compelling that he could be the QB1?
Oh, I think that it's certainly within the range of possibilities. And they're tight enough, I'll say this, Scott, they're tight enough that we know Caleb Williams, Shane Waldron, an offensive line that is gelling, Keenan Allen, DJ Moore, Cole Kmet, Gerald Everett, right? And it's not simply those, it's the commitment by the organization, as Matt Williamson put it on my show, build a nest. This is what makes Caleb Williams so different than every other quarterback that has gone number one, is they're usually rescuing a franchise at the trough, at the bottom of their curve. And he is joining a franchise that's going up. And when we look at Jaden Daniels' most likely scenario, it is going to Washington. We've already seen Cliff Kingsbury and Kyler Murray and how that went. Not great, even though it was his handpicked guy. It was a guy he's been looking at across the room for 5-6 years. He yet didn't create an atmosphere. You know, that's the interesting thing about Cliff Kingsbury and Air Raid. And I guess as we're at the cliffhanger here, some folks might be watching this after the draft. You know, is it Drake May? Isn't Drake May actually more of the Air Raid quarterback than Daniels? Now, where does Jaden Daniels go if he's not number two? New England? Don't love that. Not a fan. I mean, New England does not seem like a place that fosters the best possible development of players. And then, well, would the Raiders trade up? I think if he gets to three, the Raiders, not Minnesota. I think the Raiders have to look at it. I'm not loving that. Luke Getsy, this is the guy we're talking about what he didn't do with Justin Fields. Now he gets Jaden Daniels. So when I run through these scenarios, that's actually the gap, because Jaden Daniels, from a fantasy perspective, a deal. It's just a question of 3, 4, 5 years down the line. Are we still going to be able to count on him? I feel more confident about that with Williams, even though he doesn't have, for fantasy, quite as high of a ceiling. Now, if Daniels ends up in Minnesota, Scott, we might flip that right.
I think that was perfectly put. I think that's really important added context and nuance that I wasn't thinking about. You're right. Like, the gap between a Chicago landing spot and the other three is massive. And where it's like, hey, probably not. But like, hey, if Justin Fields went to, you know, a better OC with a better supporting cast, you know, maybe he wouldn't have been just recently traded for a round five pick. Right. So I think that's super important. And like, that's something I kind of neglect. Like, I just wrote half the length of Catcher in the Rye based on like the analytics of all these rookie players, where it's so much of it is landing spot dependent, where two guys, they're clones. One goes to the right OC who knows how to use him. The other goes to a donkey OC or a regime that's about to get turned over the following season. You know, one's a Pro Bowler, the other's a bust. And like that absolutely can be the case.
I was just going to say, DJ Moore is a perfect, you know, and he's not even in an ideal situation. He was with Justin Fields and Luke Getsy, but that's when we finally got to what DJ Moore could do. How long did it take? So, but I think what you're doing is valuable though, because what you're doing makes sense in this part of the process, because you're talking about what we know. We don't know destination yet. So I like idle chatter.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
So I don't know if you have anything to add on this. I just remember we were talking about this. So you have Brock Bauer 6 within the tier, the big crucial tier, and then at the end of it. And I think that's right. Like, looking at his analytics profile, like, I can nitpick some things, like very screen dependent, but just like his production relative to Ladd McConkey, around right. two pick, Adonai Mitchell around one, Jermaine, just smashing them. Looks, I said, like, no worse than the second best tight end prospect in at least a decade.
Right.
And so the mock draft industrial complex, we hear them saying, yeah, but like, he's not going to go so early in the draft because, you know, he's a tight end. And you look at the contracts these wide receivers are getting and the contracts the tight ends are getting, it just doesn't really make sense. And my counter was just, well, look at that second contract, because like, if you're drafting a guy here, you're expecting to get them on this second contract. And not just that, but it's like, I've always maintained that in the aggregate, tight ends aren't very valuable, but highest end tight ends are among the most valuable players in all of football. Rob Gronkowski mm-hmm. was the most valuable non-quarterback of his era when he was on the field. When he was missing games, Vegas shaved, what was it, like 4.5 points right. off of their total, which was more than any other non-quarterback by a landslide, and more than a lot of good quarterbacks. And like Steve Buzzard, who worked for you guys at Football Guys, basically does this, his own model. He was saying the exact same thing. It's like, no, Gronk is the non-quarterback GOAT of his era, elite blocker, best, you know, per target efficiency of any receiver. And that's just so valuable to an offense. And so I know we communicate a little bit about this. I don't remember mm-hmm. exactly what you said, but what are your thoughts on Brock Bowers as a prospect, maybe for fantasy, but also in terms of NFL value to a team?
And I've been quoting you. I mean, I've been quoting you a lot in this cycle, because a couple of things that you did. Well, first of all, because even though you're working from a model and you're inputting a lot of numbers, you still understand the story that those numbers tell. So when you make that, and I just quoted you on our show today about this idea that, well, let's just assume that Georgia is at, or especially in those few years, the top of college football, was the best program in college. And then you look at all of the future NFL talent that was with Brock Bowers at an early point in his career, and that they looked at these guys and they said, that guy is a guy that's going to be central in our offense. That's meaningful. That's really meaningful. We talked about breakout age and market share, whatever. That's meaningful. You know, and it makes me think that another wrinkle And then we can only do this backwards looking at how much NFL talent was a player playing with. And that makes market share a little bit different, because I think we're getting into this where it's skewing, say, like control and worthy and things like that, yards per route run and so on. But I think you pointed that out as important. And then the other thing that, and I love how, you know, you and I are birds of a feather like this, where when everybody is saying something, examine the other side. Just look at the other side. I'm not even saying you have to truck with the other side and say everyone's wrong, but at least consider it. And if the problem is you're not banking, and I just quoted you on this morning too, if you're not banking all this surplus value, oh, you know, wide receiver tops out at 30 million, quarterback 45 million, offensive tackle 30 million, whatever, and a rookie contract, you're not banking this extra money, right? Because tight end only makes 12 million or 14. If you're right about the player, and why are you drafting them if you don't think you're right, then you're going to make that back on the second contract. Because you're talking about a player that's as impactful as a wide receiver on your passing game, but you only have to pay half the amount. And the NFLPA has allowed the teams to control this, how they're listed on the depth chart. Brock Bowers could line up 100% of the snaps detached from the formation. And if they put him at tight end on the depth chart, then he's going to be a tight end when it comes to figuring out what his fifth-year option, et cetera, et cetera. So I think you put all that stuff together, and then you're saying, well, maybe a smart organization is the one looking at Brock Bowers, who everybody has as a top five overall prospect. Nobody argues about that. They just argue about where he should go in the draft because they're overthinking. And then we get into possibilities again. Jets at number 10 is where we start. Oh, that would be, I would not be. Denver at number 12, I think they don't take a quarterback. It will probably be Brock Bowers, assuming he's. Then we're looking at Indianapolis. I don't feel about that, Scott. I don't know. I mean, I want to like it. Really, what we're hoping for is that enough teams buy into this tight end devalue argument, and he falls all the way to Cincinnati, then parties on.
You just said a few things that I think were great. You kind of like cut through the noise. Like, yeah, I could riddle off yards per route run, market share stats all day on Brock Bowers, but at the end of the day, he was the best offensive player at 18 and 19 on two incredibly stacked national championship winning teams with a quarterback who was ultimately drafted day three. Like, that is just insane. And it circles back to what we were just saying about the importance of a highest end tight end. And then you also said how, like, I love picking your brain on process. I just like love the way you think. You're such a unique thinker in this space. You have to look at the other side of the argument. And that's like the most important thing. And like, that's what I do in my evaluations. Like, my rookie articles, it's basically, here is the upside argument, here is the downside argument, and here's most likely. Like, that's the way to think. But like in fantasy, just like on Wall Street, right? Like, all the best investors ever, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, Seth Klarman, they all call themselves contrarian investors because that's where all the money is. You buy low, you sell high. And in fantasy, it's the same thing. All of my best calls were the ones where I was going against the wisdom of the crowd and I fell in love with the contrarian argument. It's, Lamar Jackson sucked as a rookie. He's going to be a bust. And I'm like, I'm actually going to bet him to win MVP. And lo and behold, or Christian McCaffrey, like sophomore season, it's, he's too small. He was inefficient. And it's like, well, you know what? Le'Veon Bell was inefficient. As LaDainian Tomlinson was inefficient. And there's all these other things. So, I think I would quantify you as a contrarian as well as myself. And I think that's where all the value is in this market.
Yeah, well, it is, because this is something I try to touch on once a couple of years. Well, first, actually, since you said buy low, sell high, and I that's one of the columns I write at Football Guys is called buy low, sell high, and I've been writing it longer than some of the people that's probably been. But now, Scott, a lot of what I write up in that column is buy high, sell low, because the actual, like, the information is so good. And it's disseminated so quickly and so thoroughly that you can't find buy lows and sell highs anymore. It's actually, you have to sort through the buy lows and figure out which ones are the fugazi so you can take advantage of that. And actually, you should be, when people are saying buy low, it's really a sell low. You have to figure out which ones are the sell low. Likewise with the buy highs, right? We bought CJ Stroud when everyone was starting to wake up to how good he was 6-8 weeks in last year. You won that trade. I don't even care what you gave up. You won that trade at a time when he was a player on the rise. So I think because of that contrarian view, this is one of the weird things about doing what we do, is you have to, on some level, be aware of what other, whether that's through AP other people's articles or Twitter, or even just fielding questions, even just fielding trade questions and start sit questions. You start, okay, this is what people are actually thinking, because it isn't just being right. It's understanding where the biggest gaps, the most arbitrage is, what we think is likely to happen and what people are projecting. So, you know, I do think you have to look at what if everyone's wrong. And then the other thing I like to say is the true buy low, sell high, or getting the inflection. I always talk about it in terms of inflection. You're trying to jump in at the inflection point in a curve, either where it's topped out and it's about to come down, or it's trough and it's about to come up again. It should feel scary, right? Like the best buy low, sell high deals you make at the time, like you probably are doubting yourself. Gee, I really might be like stepping in it right now and cleaning off my shoes for a while, because if you're going contrarian, it's going to be scary. You're going to see the weight, including of people that you trust, saying this is not the right move to make. But that's what makes this fun in the end. And why people still, I mean, winning money, so on, is great. But having it be your team with your decisions, isn't this why we started doing this with GMs? So play around, have some fun, do some things that seem crazy. Because the other thing they think that people underestimate about fantasy football, or just the fortunes rising and falling, and this could go back to MLB too, you talk about baseball, all kinds of things that sound insane 3 months later become the conventional wisdom. 3 months later, that's all it takes. Sometimes 1 month later. So don't get stuck on what everybody thinks.
Yeah, I loved your point on buying high and then just like selling even higher. I was just thinking about like, imagine like being in a dynasty league in 2001, right? You're selling high on Tom Brady with a second round rookie pick, right? Or 2003, you're selling high on Tom Brady, two rookie pick. In 2006, five rookie pick. And guess what? All those are wins for you. You sold 10 first round picks and held on Tom Brady. Like that could have been the value you were getting to your flex roster. But you also mentioned arbitrage plays. And when I look at Brian Thomas, who's you have at eight, this is like one of our big disagreements, I think, except like, we're aligned with rankings. Like that's exactly where I have him. It's just like, I kept coming up with arbitrage plays I liked more. The big concern I had with him, he looked, and I think you hit on this in your write-up, is he looked pretty one-dimensional to me.
Yeah.
Or like he was a late breakout with like only one good year, and his quarterback won the Heisman in that year, and he didn't really sniff Malik Nabers. And then 50% of his yards came on just one route, the go route. It was an elite season by it was the best ever season in PFF college history by yards per deep target. But it's like, that's kind of really all he showed you. And so I like Jermaine Burton as an arbitrage play, another guy who is like really only a deep threat, but great at it. And there are a few other names like that.
Sure.
But when I look at that, I see, and again, this is my wide receiver four, but I look at that and I see a player who's probably better in real life than fantasy. Because like, think about Will Fuller, think about Torrey Smith, even DeSean Jackson. Who were those guys? They were frustratingly volatile on a week-to-week basis, better in real football than fantasy football. And then I also think about like, maybe this archetype is even worth less in today's day and age with the rise of too high coverage, you know, designed to stop the deep ball. So I don't know. Did you struggle with him as much as I did? To me, I love the big three. I think they're all guaranteed wide receiver ones, all worst case scenario, Drake London, and then a massive tier littered with wide receiver twos and threes who are going to be landing spot dependent beyond that.
Yeah, I think that I put them in an order. And look, Brian Thomas is first because he's likely to be drafted first and he's likely to be a first round pick. And I mean, think that draft capital, it matters. It matters. I'm going to quote Ryan Riddle for the second time today. Early draft picks have to prove they can't play. Late draft picks have to prove they can. So first round draft picks are going to get a lot of chances, a lot. And Brian Thomas is likely to be fourth wide receiver off the board, probably in the middle of the first round. But if he goes to Indianapolis, right, he may fall in behind five or six guys that are ahead of him, that he's ahead of right now. Like, who's Buffalo take, right? That's what everybody wants. Everybody wants Buffalo to come up for Brian Thomas. That solidifies him number four. Because then now you have a quarterback and you have a role where he doesn't have to really grow. But to your larger point, which I think is important, speed wide receivers present value in ways that don't necessarily show up on their statistics. So Xavier Worthy, even why did Henry Ruggs go as the first wide receiver in a class with? It's because it distorts the defense. And you mentioned too high safeties. You mentioned that as taking away the big play downfield. And you have to play too high safety when one of those guys is on the field. So that might diminish their stats. But now what do you have? You have the running game, and that's going to have lighter boxes for the running game. And otherwise, the spacing of the defense is going to open up more. So a player, I don't know if it was you or Thor, that compared Brian Thomas to Christian Watson. And
probably Thor, but that's a good one.
That's a good one. Yeah, I thought that was really good. Because what is Christian, now hamstring aside, what is Christian Watson going to be worth in fantasy? Because you have all of these complementary people that can play different roles. And not it's not just, okay, some weeks Christian Watson's going to have three catches for 150 yards and two touchdowns. Some weeks he might only have 15 yards. But everybody else, because the defense has devoted more attention and resources to making sure he doesn't beat them at the top. And so now where it gets really fun with someone like Brian Thomas is if he does start to develop those other parts of the route tree. And you think, really? I mean, DK Metcalf has been a hit, but not because he's learned all the other nuances of the route tree. It's just because he's so dominant and does well. And I think that's the other thing about this class that's really confounding, but also hopeful, is that the wide receiver position is segmented really out into three roles. And it's a WR position, but teams are smart and understand that we're going to only use this player in this, like, another good example is releases, right? I can't even tell you. I think Aaron Kelly comes to mind, a long receiver with some build-up speed from Clemson. I remember watching him at the Shrine Game practices. And he never even saw the field because he could not solve press coverage. He could not figure out how to get released. Teams are understanding now how to get those guys free, right? Teams, and we have so many of these little guys. You know, forget about the next Deebo Samuel. Who's the next Tank Dell, right? We have so many of these little mighty mite types in this class, Scott, where you'd say, oh boy, they're going to get manhandled by press coverage. How many snaps in the slot can you free up for a guy like this? But teams are getting better at setting up the receivers to do what they know they already do well in the context of their scheme. So that makes a circle all the way back to, where does he land? Is this team that develops players well, that puts them in roles they're going to win? Does he have a good quarterback? Is the offense going to function well, the offensive coordinator, et cetera, et cetera? And that means whatever the second tier, 4 to whatever, 16, it's going to get totally shuffled. If you're not shuffling it based on what happens in the draft, then you're not being honest about how important that is to their eventual outcome.
Yeah. So you just mentioned this, and I think you retweeted a thread I did about this, particularly that Xavier Worthy and Troy Franklin, the low BMI speedsters, are going to be the most landing spot dependent wide receivers in this class. It was based around this quote from Greg Cassell, who was saying, Tank Dell wouldn't have been drafted 5 years ago. But now in today's day and age, with forward thinking OCs, they're getting players like this free access off the ball where their route isn't impeded by press or physical bigger cornerbacks, allowing them to show their strengths with like lateral agility and explosiveness and things like that. And that's so massively important. And so for Franklin and Worthy, I'm like, very, very landing spot dependent. Where do you want them to go? You want them to go to a motion heavy team.
Right.
And no surprise, the top six motion heavy teams are all the best offenses in football. It's one Mike McDaniel far and away, and then it's Chiefs, right. Lions, Rams, all the best ones. And so for those two players, you're really looking for that. And that was another knock on Worthy as well, or just like a weird concern, was that his OC, or no, his head coach was Devonta Smith's OC in his Heisman winning season, where it's like, okay, maybe he knew how to mitigate the size concerns. But if you put him with like a Jeff Fisher in the NFL, like, all right, I'm really worried about Xavier Worthy. You give him a Sean McVay, and I'm like, this is going to be fun. But I wanted to circle back. What was the quote on the importance of draft capital? What was the quote you just listed off?
Ryan Riddle, who wrote some tremendous stuff to report back in the day from the player. Early round picks have to can't, and late round picks have to. So, and in the end, it may not matter, because if you're an early round pick and you get multiple opportunities, don't have it, then you don't have it. You don't have it on the fourth time and the fifth time in the same either. But I do think that draft capital represents how long the leash is going to be, how patient a team is going to be with the player. It may not actually change the long-term outcome, but you know, a player like Devontae Adams, I mean, he wasn't a first-round pick, but still, he was a player that they had envisioned a lot for, so they weren't just going to move on from him and go well earlier in his career. So I think that matters. And I think it also, on the flip side, means we have to be patient with some of the later round picks, you know, and then we can play these what if games. Like, if Isaiah Pacheco got drafted to a different team, would we even be talking about him? So opportunity is important, but obviously what they do with the opportunity is what determines in the
Draft capital is so predictive and so important, in part because All right, you and I talk about the assumption of rational coaching a lot. Well, what about the correct assumption of self-interested GMs, right? Yeah. And so I always think back on Adam Thielen, who was competing against Cordarrelle Patterson, a round one pick, Greg Jennings, who signed a big contract. And the beat writers at the time, like rookie sophomore season, are like, this is the best wide receiver on the field. He's blowing our minds. And it took him so long to break out. And then I also think about Steve Keim. I forget who the wide receiver, Trent Sherfield, I think he was interviewed after he left the organization. And he was like, yeah, I was told by a coach, you're like, deserve to be a starter, but the GM doesn't want to see you play. He wants to see the drafted guys play. Because like, it makes him look bad when the UDFAs are outplaying his second round picks. I'd like, what about Greg Dortch? Like I've been saying for years, Greg Dortch is just a better Rondale Moore, but he's a UDFA, so you're not going to see him play. And so, yeah, I have all these concerns with Brian Thomas, but ultimately wide receiver four, and a big reason why is because of that projected draft capital. I will tell you, if we could have a little therapy session for a second, is there was a point during this process, because I don't remember a year with the wide receivers where the film versus the analytics were so misaligned. We're like Adonai Mitchell, it's like, it's only red flags. There's not a single green flag in there. And for a lot of these guys, older players, not very productive, but supposedly a top six, top 10 wide receiver in the class, where I had this moment of nihilism where I was just like, is really draft capital all that matters? And like, where it's just, you could have a clone of two players. One goes round two, the other goes round six. The round six guy's out of the league in a year. The round two guy's great. Like, he's a good fantasy player, but it's just, you're not invested in his success as a GM. You give them more opportunities to succeed. If you fail, you get excuses made. And yeah, and like, we don't have say over, you know, how to use a player. We're like, I think Worthy is a guy who needs motion and all this other stuff. He's great on screens and then uses deep speed. But it's like, you give him a Jeff Fisher and it's just like, oh, this guy's a bust.
Yeah, we're necessity. Quentin Johnson, I think, is a terrific example of this, where just misfortune for his team, right? And this is where I think that the film watching and even the analytics and all of the work that is done by people like you to set the scene. Here's the landscape of this player based on what we need for they get drafted. Here's where they struggle. Here's where they're strong and so on. Quentin Johnson was a player that you could see go in the first round. I mean, well, first of all, just as a quick aside, where does Quentin Johnson rank in this class?
Oh, right.
Like 9th, 11th, right? Right. Quentin Johnson. I mean, geez, you're actually looking at like Xavier Leggett and you're like Quentin Johnson or Xavier Leggett. You know what I mean? In this class. In last year's class, some people had him number one on their board because he's big, because he's fast, and because he does know what to do once he has the ball in his hand. Now, that kind of slot. And that's the other thing about the slot. When I say that it's segmented into three positions, well, geez, even slot is segmented into big slot and little slot. So it's not even, you know, you can sub-classify these guys based on roles within roles. But Quentin Johnston, everybody who was being honest about him said he's not ready to be an outside receiver yet. You're drafting him in the first round on a projection. And if you're using him as a rookie, here's what he's proven he can do now. Well, because Williams gets hurt, because Josh Palmer gets hurt, the Chargers have to use him outside and he looks terrible. Well, guess what? He still can't do what he couldn't do. You know, he's still not a contested catch guy. He's still not a guy. Yeah, he's fast. Yeah, he's big. That hasn't changed. But yeah, in the NFL, no, he's not ready for NFL competition at corner. Then you confidence. So this is another thing about a player's trajectory of their career. It's confidence and how much of a role that plays and whether you're given too much too early or whether you're doing like Puka Nacua. Puka Nacua, if you were paying attention last year, Jordan Rodriguez told us, wow, it looks like they plan on him doing a lot this year. From rookie minicamp and OTAs, he was saying that. And at every point, he met their expectations. So then they added more. And then he met the expectations and they added more. I don't care what Puka Nacua was in your draft rankings or even after he got taken. That's where you actually win in your diet. And that's where you buy high, right? Oh, someone took him in the third round. Maybe if I give you a future second right now. So that's where you can win. But playing all these counterfactual scenarios, I mean, when you said clone a player, I think that's it, right? I mean, I like to say, now we're going to really on the couch. You want to talk about therapy. I mean, I one of the things I like to say myself is thank the heavens that we don't have another version of ourselves, that we can try the other choice in our lives, right? It's actually a great burden lifted that you don't have to worry about whether you made the right choice or not. Because for all you know, if you had made the other choice, it'd be even worse. You would be even worse off. So just keep looking forward and keep living your life like these teams. But I think that's the scenario. The one that I always bring up is Bryce Young and CJ Stroud. Mm-hmm. Bryce Young had gone Texans, CJ Stroud had gone to the Panthers. How different are the stories we're telling about? How different are the stories we're telling about these franchises? I don't know, but I think it highlights how important.
No, I love that. You know, I always live by everything happens for a reason, or like the best outcomes, or we live in the best of all possible worlds. The best outcome is always, you know, whatever you ultimately chose, because like you might as well just think that way, right? You're just better off.
Yeah.
I'm looking back at these rankings. You're pretty bullish on Jonathan Brooks in comparison to the consensus.
Yes.
And I completely agree. Like in this class, like far and away the best three down potential, which is just massive for fantasy. In a PPR league, targets are worth 2.5 times as much as a carry, and no one other running back in this class has that upside. I also think like his ADP is going to skyrocket because he's going to be the first or second running back off the board. And there are some good landing spots. So why don't you tell me a little bit about Jonathan Brooks and what you're envisioning in terms of draft capital and ideal landing spot?
Yeah. And I think that the important thing here is that he's the only back in this class you can comfortably project as a, right? Unless he doesn't get all the way back from it. He has the well-rounded skill set of a three down back. The other backs, I mean, Trey Benson has the makings of a three down back, but he hasn't been used as one yet. So I think that it could make us wonder, but, and he'll go a little higher than Damian Pierce, but you know, I think that we're saying sort of similar things about, well, if Damian Pierce, maybe he was in a committee in college, but he wasn't supposed to be, he didn't need, and we'll find that out. Well, I'm not comparing them directly, except to say that when a player you know, again, what's meaningful, you mentioned players that had low efficiency in the rookie year, like Christian McCaffrey and LaDainian Tomlinson. Well, what was Le'Veon Bell? What was meaningful? Was it meaningful they had low efficiency, or was it meaningful that as a rookie, their teams trusted them that much to handle that much of the offense? Well, in hindsight, we can see for all three of those guys, it was the volume and the trust as a rookie that was more, not what they were able to do with it, to get opportunity to refine their game. I think Jonathan Brooks, he projects as a three down back, comfortably as a three down back. And then what I really like about Brooks when you watch him, Scott, he looks like a veteran running back. I mean, he makes decisions like a veteran running back, right? The way he engages with contact. And he's not the strongest back in this class, but he can get yards after contact. He's not the most elusive. He doesn't have the most, but he can force missed tackle. He's not the fastest, but he can break long run. So he's not the superlative of anybody, any of these particular things. But when you put them all together, you have a foundational running back. And I think that he's the only one in this class. And even if he goes to Carolina, I think Dallas or Carolina, even if he goes to Dallas or Carolina, if he goes to Carolina, I'm not going to move him out of that number one. I mean, I think my next player at running back, I think I have him sixth in one quarterback lead, and my next running back's at eight. So it would take something pretty astounding. Because the thing about Jonathan Brooks also is, I don't even necessarily care where he lands. Even if he lands somewhere where he's blocked this year or next year. I mean, running back's a young man's position. It's going to churn. You know, if the Texans draft him, he's behind Joe Mixon. I mean, by the middle of next year, that backfield, that might actually be the best case scenario. Because he's going to converge with an offense that's ascending instead of an offense like Carolina, where maybe he'll overtake Chuba Hubbard really quickly, overtake him in terms of the lion's share of the backfield touches, but in a bottom half, even bottom quarter of the league offense.
That's partly why I liked Brooks so much, is like, I don't see him as landing spot dependent. Like you throw Blake Corum to the Panthers, that sucks. You know, they're trailing every game. He's not getting carries. He's not getting targets. But you put Brooks there, it's like, okay, they're trailing in every game. He's not getting a lot of carries, but now they're peppering him with targets, right?
Right.
And so volume far and away, the most important, or it's just about everything when it comes to fantasy running backs. Yeah. And so I project him to be a volume running back. One running back who, it surprised me how high you were on him. I actually didn't write him up. And this is the one player who, you know, if I can find the time, maybe I'll add him before the draft, is Kamani Vidal.
Yeah.
My model has a strong bias against group of five running backs, and he wasn't projected to go earlier than round five. So I never got around to him. So why don't you tell me why I should add him to my article and get excited about him?
So many people have him as their favorite. And I want the Matt Waldman RSP. You will see that Waldman thinks he can play. And he is a proven volume back. Now you're right. You have to devalue that a little bit because of Troy, but still, I mean, there's a durability question that comes up there. And also he had a three down skill set. But as I know, I mean, he's only 40th overall, highly likely to be a third day. And he's going to have to be one of those guys that can prove he can play. And again, Isaiah Pacheco is a good example where, you know, if Isaiah Pacheco had landed somewhere else, we might not be talking about him yet. I mean, even Chuba Hubbard isn't. breakout running back, but it took a while for us to even talk about Chuba Hubbard. But there are others. I think that you have a sleeper running back tier. I know Blake Watson just made General Jeremiah's top 150. He's another one. Dylan Johnson, I know, is a favorite of Matt Waldman. He's another one. So, you know, we have these running backs that are not going to go in the top 10 running backs off the board, or it would surprise if they go in the top 10 off the board, but they've shown more skills and more things that translate as compared to, so here's some running backs I have below Vidal, like Isaac Garendo or Braylon Allen. You know, these are guys that have the physical trait that the NFL really love, but they haven't necessarily shown to unlock them with skills consistently. And it ain't going to be easier to do that in the NFL than it was in college. Bucky Irving is another guy I think that is a little bit polarizing. You know, Bucky Irving could be another Kyren Williams. You know, could be another guy. Don't tell me about the measurables. Tell me what he did with the ball in his hands and show me how much of his game is based skill. Or Bucky Irving could be like another Jaquizz Rodgers, who I liked. I'd like Jaquizz Rodgers.
Yeah, me too. I was a big fan.
You know, his limitations limited his upside. So, you know, there's a lot of this where glass half full, glass half empty. And I think that if we're being honest as analysts, we're just trying to tell a story where we say, if this player succeeds, it will be because this, this, and this are the determinative factors in their outcome. And if he fails, it'll probably be because of this, this, and this. And then as you track their career, you start to see, okay, which path are we on? And you can maybe act before you get all the evidence. Because I think that's the number one thing you can take advantage of fantasy football. There's so many people that are like, no, I want more evidence. I want more evidence. Can I just have one more piece of evidence before I buy into this? And if you're an early adopter, because you've massaged your brain with Scott's work, with Matt Waldman's work, with Dane Brugler's, there's so many people doing. So absorb it all. And then as you are reading and watching football, a path illuminates. You're like, oh, okay, this guy, Isaiah Pacheco, right? What did Isaiah Pacheco have going for effort? Oh my gosh. Effort. He ran the ball like his life depended on it. He had to get the message through enemy lines or his country was going to lose the war. So once you put him next to the other options in Kansas City, yeah, he's going to stand out. Yeah, and there's going to be enough for him to stand out and then take hold of that. So you want to understand what the strengths and weaknesses are. So you understand what's coming next. And I think with this running back class, three or four or five of them, other than Brooks, are going to have at least some periods of fantasy relevance. I can't say which guys, those guys, not yet.
Yeah, I just want to say shout out to Matt Waldman and the RSP. I've been a reader since Amir Abdullah. I was going to war for Amir Abdullah. And I know he was high on him that year. So we just talked about Vidal, I think is like one of your favorites. Who are some of your favorites? Like, you're in a rookie draft. I don't want to leave the rookie draft without him. I love this guy. I'm going to keep up for him. One of my guys, Jaheim Bell. I appreciate. I saw the shout out in the article. He would be on my list. Who are some of the players on your list?
Well, I'll say at tight end, Benson, and I know a lot of people are on the bench, but this is a guy that I know Matt Wall was talking about him in the plow game. He's on the snow. I got to talk about Dane Brugler's beast again, because it always starts with my biological information. And one of the things about him in the beat, he didn't play football until he was in fourth grade, because he didn't want to play flag football. He wanted to hit people, because he was a hockey player since he was 3 years old. Imagine the hockey team with him and JJ McCarthy. He was a hockey player since 3 years old. And he played something like six or seven sports school, I want to say. But what I really love about Benson, and sometimes Scott, I'm an emotional fantasy football player. I'm an emotional GM. I go on hunches. Yeah, I go on gut feeling. I mean, I have to live my life coloring between my fantasy team some fun. And he just has that joyful warrior, Rob Gronkowski, George Kittle kind of approach to his game, where he likes it. He likes how brutal the tight end is. He thrives on it. I think that Ben Sinnott, and this is a really interesting tight end class, because you could make an argument from a fantasy perspective for any number of, I don't know, four, five, six guys to be the number two tight end after Brock Bowers. And we can see with some of these guys on the rise now, a Trey McBride, a Sam Laporta. You know, McBride was the first tight end off the board in his class, but he wasn't this generational prospect. He was a second round pick, and he was a somewhat limited second round. He wasn't always going to be a do everything tight end. Now look how valuable he got really quickly. Look how valuable Sam Laporta. These are your number one and number two dynasty tight ends. Where were they at the beginning of the season? Were they even in the top 10? And now they're one and two in most rankings, if not one and two, very close to. And I think that one of these guys, again, Bell, I think, is a good example. I love the case you lay out for him in terms of analytics. Sanders has more of the prospect traits profile that will translate. And he held his own with Worthy and with Mitchell as a viable prospect. Eric All is interesting. We don't scout based on helmets, but at some point you have to say this program knows how to identify talent and develop it, right?
That's yeah. What
and Eric All has the medicals that you have to worry about. But again, if a team is willing to take him in the third round, you should probably be willing to take him in.
I love it. I think one thing you're going to do way better than I can do, although I have to get started on my mock draft tonight if I'm going to do one. Best or ideal landing spots, or like worst possible landing spots, just like any landing spots you're directly rooting for. Lad McConkey, the Chiefs, does his ADP just go nuclear? Is there any landing spot for the big three wide receivers where you would get nervous? Any thoughts on these landing spots?
Yeah, I want the receiver that's paired with Kyler Murray. I think it's going to be him. It should be because we saw what he did with DeAndre Hawk. Kyler is not, I think Kyler's a great buy low right now, especially in terrific, terrific buy low. And part of it is because he's going to get paired up with somebody, one of the top. And if it's not one of the top three, that means they just got a boatload. Okay. So then they're still going to take wide receivers. I think you're looking at a draft, not the Andy Isabella Hakeem Butler draft, but you know, hopefully better picks than Andy Isabella Hakeem Butler. But I think you're going to see the Cardinals go to the well more than once at wide receiver to help out Kyler Murray. But I think you also see Kyler Murray not necessarily playing with a lot of subtlety. It's like, hey, Marvin Harrison Jr. gets open on every play. When he's not open, he's open. It's the play. I'm going to throw to Marvin Harrison Jr. the same way I threw DeAndre Hopkins. The worrisome one, I think, and in a general sense, Scott, I think Saquon Barkley's there, right? How do you feel about Saquon Barkley now that he's... Because you're going from a situation that was almost impossible to a situation that's right? Mm-hmm. So, I'll give you another example. I've seen Malik Nabers compared to Garrett Wilt, you know? I mean, in terms of like the kinds of the abilities he brings to the field, right? Now, maybe this is a reason to not be too scared of taking Malik Nabers the Giant, because Garrett Wilson the Jet, even through all of his struggles, is still very, very valuable because everybody can see he can play. Get a quarterback and get the ball to him consistently for one of these years and stay healthy. And I think that you might be looking at that as the Nabers first 3 or 4 years of his, if he lands.
So two things I want to say. Cardinals are in like, this is what they desperately need. They need an outside wide receiver one. And so they are in the perfect spot. I've heard rumors per sources. They really like Odunze. I don't know if that's true. You know, you never know with these sources stuff, but I mean like Marv or Odunze on the outside is so crucial. Last year, Trey McBride, I think, ranked 15th among all players in yards per route run against zone, second among tight ends. So like feasting against zone. And then against man, Arizona was a bottom three team. Michael Wilson just about basically averaged 0.00 yards per route run against man. And Rondale Moore ranked bottom five of like 125 qualifiers. So that is what they desperately need. I love that. I will say, and maybe it's just because I'm a Giants fan and I want them to draft Nabers so badly. I kind of like the spot. Like, I think there's a higher floor than people are giving credit for, where like I'd be a buyer just because like I think he can do. Brian Daboll, a former wide receiver coach, coached some great slots in New England. I think he could do a lot of the Wandale Robinson stuff at a bare minimum and do it at a much higher level, and then could also be their wide receiver one, where, you know, maybe the quarterback play is brutal, but like they have no one else anyway. And so volume is enough to overcome that. But that could just be my... Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, and you make it really simple. Like, you set up some structure around Jones, kind of like what was set up around Chris, where it's like, we don't want you to think that's the last thing we want. Like, or Colin Kaepernick. Maybe that's a better comparison. Colin Kaepernick was never going to sit back there and go, should have won the Super Bowl. I mean, it didn't last, but I think you can do that with Dan. And kind of like what we saw with Gardner Minshew and Michael Pittman, like just Nabers is the read. Nabers is the guy you're going to throw. You know, it absolutely could work. There's a lot of uncertainty. I mean, and then again, that all comes back to why this is so difficult. Because I'll tell you, you know, I'll wear my L's. I'll own them. I don't care. There's plenty of them. Anybody, you're not saying anything interesting. Big L's. Probably one of my least favorite landing spots ever for a player that I liked was AJ Brown landed. I think I moved him down to 17th or 18th in my ranking.
Same.
So like how is he going to get it done in Tennessee? Sometimes a player is just so good that all the things that seem to apply to their situation before they showed up don't apply anymore because they're that influential on the offense. And Nabers absolutely.
Sig, this was amazing. This is beautiful. Yeah. I promised you a non-football question to cap it off. I'm going to ask you, what is like some piece of media you've consumed over the past several months, whether it's a book, music, TV show, movie that you've fallen in love with or you can't stop thinking about?
Yeah. I will go, actually, I'll do two answers. One, I'll go back to, it actually goes back to football. And we've both been listening. When I say we, I mean the love of my life. We've been listening to Across the River, which is that Kent Babb, standing sports writer, outstanding writer, wrote when he was embedded with the Edna Carr football team here across the river on the West Bank in New Orleans. And they won four straight state championships as a public school majority African-American school. Which is, if you know about the highest levels of high school football, I mean, Louisiana, this is a football hotbed. Southeast Louisiana is right there with Miami as like the football hotbed in America. And they won four straight state champions. How could they possibly do it? And they let Kent Babb have complete access. They even told him, like, we want you to write everything. Like, we don't want you to filter it. It is eye-opening to say the least. What goes on, and especially in a place where hear these kids saying, like, I feel safe when I'm at the football program. What might happen when I'm not? There's a lot of stories about that too. So the book is Across the River, and then Hulu did a series called Algiers America, which kicks in the next year after Across the River. And it's a little more cinematic. It's a little more overtures, operatic than all of the amazing and you are there kind of you get from Across the River. They're both incredible. Edna Carr, Patrick Sertan went to Edna Carr. I think one of the latest players to come out of Edna Carr was free. Anyway, so check out, if that sounds interesting, the Edna Carr program, Across the River, Algiers America, but not so much media, because I'm going to bring in live music. I might love live music more than football. I did get to see a concert about 3 months ago, Lucinda Williams. And Lucinda Williams is not that, like, her stomping grounds was like, you know, Lake Charles Triangle, but just like down I-10 from you, and then Austin, outlaw country. And she's still doing it. She's still out there, even after she had a stroke. And we got to go see her at a little place here called Chickiwawa that was a really small room for Lucinda Williams. And I was just in awe because it's somebody that was actually there. Somebody had, like, when she sings a song about Tom Petty, she sings a song about Blaze Foley. Look it up, folks, Blaze Foley, Austin. She really lived it. And her music, the best way I can put it, there's a lot of gospel music about being found. There's a lot of gospel music about when you're saved. But there's another side. The other side is, how does it feel when you're lost? How does it feel when you want to be saved, who don't know if you deserve to be saved or something like that, when you're off? And Lucinda Williams' music is such a wonderful companion to those times in your life. And it really came through getting to see her. So I recommend check. There's an album she did called, I think, Gravel Wheels on a Dirt Road or something like that she did in the 90s. Incredible stuff. So yeah, those are some things that have stuck with me.
Well, the theme you're describing right now, mm-hmm. that she's uncovering with her work reminds me of my favorite writer, Dennis Johnson. I've gifted over and over again, Jesus' Son.
That's a classic. Mm-hmm. That makes me think of Drugstore Cowboy. Have you ever seen Drugstore Cowboy?
No.
Oh, man.
I'll check it out.
Drugstore Cowboy is set like in Oregon. It's 70s. It's a tremendous film. I think Gus may be wrong. Put that on your list. Next time I talk to you, you better have seen Drugstore Cowboy. If you love Jesus' Son, you.
All right. Well, I just added all these to my list. I'm going to be selfish and try and sneak in one more question.
Okay. Yeah.
But just in case you have one, if you don't have an answer, that's all right. What is like a burning football topic that you haven't really talked about, but you want to talk about? For some reason, I kind of want to ask you about Belichick. And like, to me, it's just so weird that he's not hired. So that's a possibility.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, Belichick kind of intersects with what I was going to say. Here's the burning football topic. So let's talk real quickly about Belichick. Everyone should check out that Seth Wickersham. I can't remember the other writer that did it. Like,
yeah, he's so good.
Well, because people talk to him. People tell him stuff that they pull, right? So a lot of really embarrassing stuff for Belichick, right? Not exactly painting Belichick, not even just Belichick, the entity as a football coach, but how he's thought of it. The question I ask when I read that article is, why is this getting out there? Who's putting this out here and why? It still is a Tom Brady. There's still some sort of like feud. You also have this documentary series that players were coming to Belichick's defense, right? And saying, why are they only portraying the negative? Even the Kraft family was like, oh, if we would have known that was what it was going to be, we might not have even contributed to, even though there's a Kraft name on there. And there was some quotes about what the Kraft said. Like Robert Kraft called Arthur Blank and said, don't hire Bill Belichick. You won't have a warm conversation. Now, I'm also going to add in here Hunter Henry. I don't know if you saw what Hunter Henry said about Jared Mayo, not about Bill, but they did say, ask him, how has it changed with Mayo? More player, you are, you're standing. His energy lights up a room. And the other one he said, and even the way he said it, he said something to the effect, Scott, of like, you know, just listen to us sometime. You know, try that. Try listening. Mm-hmm. So that, and that was in response to how it's changed. So I think that this Belichick story intersects with the Williams story. What's the thing that you keep hearing? Gosh, it's painful, Scott, when you anonymous scouts and stuff like that on Caleb Williams. They just don't understand young people. They just don't understand young, but they frame it as like, I don't know about this guy. He's hiding something. I don't know how the locker room's going to react. I don't know how the fans, well, how is he going to do if he faces adversity? You're just saying he makes me uncomfortable. I don't know how to process. And that may be why Belichick didn't really get it, because there's this sense of old dog and new tricks. And, you know, it's one thing to be a figurehead like Mike McCarthy, where the team's already used to running itself. And that's not the Belichick program. Belichick's not going to be a figurehead. And I think that while he has something that worked at one time, I don't know if he can, this coming generation of players, like a former player, like a Jared May. And I do think you're going to see the cocoon of old school, like stuck in the past, think NFL, the franchises that hold on to that mentality are just going to fall farther and farther.
Yeah, you said something about this makes them uncomfortable because they don't understand this generation. And I'm thinking about, there are scattering reports from 15 years ago where it's like, this player has tattoos and like, that's right. A red flag. So
right.
It really could just boil down to that. But circling back to Belichick, and you have to understand, I'm biased. I'm like a huge Belichick homer,
sure,
because he's given the Giants so many Super Bowls. And I just think he's hilarious. You're saying like, there's all these negative reports in that article. And that's true. The Falcons sources were like a little bit more generous. They were like, yeah, he's comfortable working with the GM. He doesn't need total control. And then there's all these other negative sources. And it's like, my favorite quote, Charlie Munger, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. And it's like, who has the incentive to be bad mouthing Belichick to such a degree? And it has to be Kraft, right? Because like, how bad do you look if you let Brady walk, he wins a Super Bowl, you let Belichick walk, he crushes, then you look like an absolute idiot. Right. So they're like incentivized to see him fail. And then you're reading this article and it's all these GMs or people talking about, well, he thinks he's smarter than you. And so that's a big concern. Guess what? He is smarter than you. Like maybe he lost touch with like the younger generation or whatever. He's too much of a hard ass. He is undoubtedly like one of the top three smartest minds who have ever lived when it comes to football. Right. And then, like, another big concern was from the Eagles and a couple other organizations was like, well, what if he just retires after he breaks the record and then you only get 3 years from him and then you're starting over? To me, if I were an owner, like, I don't care. Like, I am hiring him because in those 3 years, I'm going to be made so much better off for it. Everyone within my organization is going to become so much smarter that like 3 years of Belichick is worth more than anyone else. And like, you know, he probably just, yeah, my son's ready. And then you give the son a shot or something, but
yeah,
I could just be the world's biggest Belichick homer, but that's what I got out of the article.
I don't think that's outlandish. I think you have to have the right situation, though. I mean, I'm reminded of the Giants finally winning a Super Bowl with Coughlin, because that was the year that he led up, right? That was the report. Because in 2007 was finally the year that Coughlin's like, all right, all y'all have gotten better with my tough love, and I'm going to actually relax. You know, I'm going to let, I trust you. I'm going to let you spread your wings. And I think that if Belichick could be brought into a situation where a lot of them were there, but they needed, you know, maybe the Chargers, you know, that you needed a discipline. You needed somebody like whatever, a group of kids, because mom and dad were always gone, were kind of like raising themselves. And then at a certain point, that's great because it creates independence and self-reliance. But then maybe having a role model can help too. You know, and maybe coming into that kind of situation. But the other side of that, I think that also was mentioned in the article, is if you hire Belichick, you're installing Belichick system. You know, you're not going to half measure Belichick. You're not going to have, I mean, having Belichick as part of a committee, and I'm not saying you can make him an emperor, but there's the Belichick way, you know, do your job way. And when you commit to that, I don't know if it's so much the 2 or 3 years down the line, I would just come back to like, is that going to be an approach that resonates now? It's always one of those eternal questions, Scott, like winning is the great deodorant, right? I mean, you tolerate all kinds of things you're winning. Mm-hmm. And the very same things you will not tolerate. When,
you know who tried the Patriot system? Matt Patricia, Josh McDaniels, like seven other
new. I think that Belichick himself said they were all better soldiers in general.
Which is a great quote, by the way. Yeah, so you just mentioned Tom Coughlin, and I'm a Giants fan, like love Tom Coughlin. The one thing you hear is like, even from the players who hated him at the time, like he was such a hard ass, but I love him so much. Like I would go to war for him. I would take a bullet. I love that man with all my heart. And I don't think you've ever heard that from Belichick. Like, I don't know that he can relate to people on an emotional level where he's really just like a robot. Do your job. And so like that could be holding him back. I wonder if you get to see like, well, he's doing this Pat McAfee show for the live stream, which is either going to be really entertaining or like not at all. But I'd like to see him kind of let his hair down a little bit and show some personality if he has.
And he does this time of year, right? It would always be at this time of year or before the draft, like around the combine. And someone would ask him a question about football and he would go on this 7-minute story. And
or fullbacks or long snappers.
Right. Something close to his heart. And then you would see like he actually has a lot of interest and he actually, there are times that maybe he won't light up a room, but he lights up. There is emotion. There is sentiment. But when it came time to switch to football season, like, you're right. I don't know that he was somebody that was touchy in any kind of way, not even like behind closed doors when, you know, because I think the other thing is, Scott, and again, this I think is 21st century thinking, is the right management style is to evaluate the person you work with and what works for them. Mm-hmm. There is no one right answer. And I don't know if Bill Belichick too late for to really on that. And that's okay because he is he's on the Mount Rushmore of coaches. He's a football. He's not even just a football encyclopedia or supercomputer. He kind of has merged with capital F football. He's kind of like Vince Lombardi. Like you think of like football personified, but he's football in the rear view modified. What he needs to be is like what Rich McKay's doing. The very guy that they thought was an obstacle to him being the head coach in Atlanta is a consultant. Is someone you run things past, emeritus, who's sitting there to say, well, have you thought about this before you do that? But not necessarily somebody that has the final say. But I look forward to seeing you. And, you know, I think that's, again, part of what makes the draft so much fun. If you're a New England fan, finally, you're going to get to draft in a way that's not the Belichick way. That was the weakest part of all of his.
I feel like when he was there, like the GMs, I mean, the scouts must have like put so much effort into like, is he a personality fit? Because like more than anyone else, like he broke Mac Jones, or at least that's the narrative. Is he just like mentally broke Mac Jones and ruined him? And like Tom Brady, like, okay, well he coached, he turned a backup into the greatest of all time with his coaching. That's incredible. But it also wore Tom Brady thin and where he was trying to get out and go to Tampa Bay. And so, that's an important factor. I don't think you ever really hear a lot. Yeah, he makes it tougher on them.
And the word was, people are starting to talk now. Isn't it funny when there's like years and years when nobody's talking, well, check way, and now people are talking. The word was, I can't remember who reported this or where it was anonymously quoted, that the coaches basically got to overrule the scouts. That the scouts would do all this work all year, and then so much would be based on, and not just personality fit, although I think you're right, that's really just fit in the scheme, because the scheme was a little more rigid. Or what they were looking for was more rigid. This is why the Patriots reportedly always had the smallest board of any team. They would always have a very, you know, 100, 120. This year I heard it for Sam to say like this many players are draftable on our board because you have all of these filters, all these knockout factors where you just don't look at certain players because they don't fit what you're looking for. But I think, again, flexibility is so important in NFL now. And, so Patriots fans will see. That's in some ways where the real draft starts if Jaden Daniels. But the good news is we won't be talking about ifs in a couple of days.
Well, I'm excited for that. We definitely going to do a show together.
Yes.
Maybe on your home turf after the draft, talk about some of these landing spots. Sig, thank you so much for having coming on.
Yeah.
You want to tell the folks at home anything about what you're cooking up, your podcast, your home site, footballguys.com, now home to Football Writer of the Year, Adam Harstad. Shout out, Adam.
Isn't that awesome?
It's great. So overdue.
Yeah. Well, and what I love is it gives me so much hope for our community that someone like Adam Harstad can be the football writer, because I could never dream of esoteric as far as jumping between references, taking something out of psychology or something out of science and applying it to football, to fantasy football. we're going to be live during the first round, Matt Waldman and I and a bunch of guests just reacting. I mean, not whatever. We'll have plenty of time to comb through all of this and do our rookie and react to what happens in the, in a actionable advice way. The fun thing during the draft is hanging out with your people, experiencing all the oohs and ahs that happen, the laughter, the tears, doing that. Cecil and I will be on the Audible on our podcast going through division by division the following week. Bloom 100 with post-draft rankings will come out probably Tuesday. If you want, it's going to hit me on Monday. If you have a draft going, it's fun. You know, maybe fly on instruments. I don't know. I don't know if I'm or not, but it's great, man. And I'm just glad that we get to spend this time together. And most importantly, like Adam Harstad, like Matt Waldman, like all these people we're talking about, the fantasy football world is really great at letting us be us, right? We aren't trying to all be like each other. In fact, we're trying to be more, we're not trying to not be like each other. We're just trying to be like ourselves, which makes each of us offer something we can offer. We owe the audience a lot of gratitude for that because there aren't many places to work and feel like you can just show up to work and be yourself.
I love that. Folks at home, that's a takeaway for you. Don't try and be anyone else. Just try and be more like yourself. Sig, yeah. This was a blast. You killed it. Thanks for coming on. See you guys all soon.
Thanks for tuning in to this edition of the Fantasy Points Podcast. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite platform. And come join the roster at fantasypoints.com.